Welcome to It's All Politics from NPR News. I'm Ron Elving. And you're amused. Why don't you just say your name, and then you can tell us why you're so amused.
I'm Ken Reardon, but I wish the listener could see your face every time we start the podcast. You have this amazing look on your face like we're going to say something of interest.
Yeah, I often feel as though we are, and then, of course, you know, reality intrudes.
But the news is that Congress is gone, and there are a lot of people in this country who would love to see perhaps a majority of this Congress gone permanently.
You know, you're absolutely right. The one thing that a Congress can do that has become this unpopular is to go home and try to explain itself to its constituents rather than to stay in Washington and either pass legislation, which oftentimes doesn't prove to be that popular, or stay in Washington and wrangle and fail to pass
legislation. What's the point of staying in Washington anyway? We all know that nobody is getting along. Nobody is going to acquiesce on any kind of a vote that could help one party or the other.
It's a struggle for them just to pass a continuing resolution to keep the federal government funded past September 30th, the end of the fiscal year, and to go home having passed no appropriations bills as far as the president's desk, and the Senate hasn't taken any up, and doing this thing they call a continuing resolution just to keep all of the previous funding continuous into the new fiscal year. I mean, that's so minimal, and even that is a struggle for this Congress.
But they did what the American people wanted. They passed the Bush tax cuts.
No, they didn't.
They didn't?
Well, they passed them in 2001 and 2003.
Oh, they didn't do
but
it this time?
The extension of the I know you're being – I'm sorry. You're being ironic.
Yes.
You're being arch. This is kind of a meta thing.
It's kind of metamucil. Actually, I never met a mucil I didn't like.
If there is anyone still listening to this podcast, perhaps we should explain a little bit of what we're talking about. Congress is only worried now about the November 2nd elections, which, after all, is all we're really worried about most of the time on this podcast. And so let's talk a little bit about some of those races.
No, but before you do that, I mean, the Democrats for the longest time said, look, it's very important that we get rid of the Bush tax cut for the folks making over $250,000 a year.
No, they said it was more important that they extend the tax cuts for everybody but the last 2%, 3%.
And John Boehner got into this whole battle with his fellow Republicans saying,
if the only option I have is to vote for some of those tax reductions, I'll vote for him.
So we expected, one would expect, that there would be a battle, a debate, and a vote.
But he was slapped down immediately by the other Republicans saying, no, we are not going to pass tax cut extensions for 97% of the people in the country until we can get it for the other 3%. And they made their argument on the basis of jobs, the thing that everyone cares about more than anything else in this election year. They said, sure, some of those $1 million a year people may not seem needy, but they use some of that money generated by small businesses in some cases to hire other people. So if you want to kill jobs, fine, tax the rich. But if you want to create jobs, let the rich keep not just the first $250,000, but the tax cut on money over $250,000 a year as well. And that seems to be a pretty popular point of view, according to the polls.
Well, it probably scared off a lot of Democrats, too, because even though Nancy Pelosi at one point had said that she wants that vote, she wants to make the November 2nd election a stark contrast between tax cuts for the rich Republicans and us for the middle class, there are many Democrats who said, I don't want to vote to raise the taxes on the wealthy because it will be perceived in 30-second commercials as I'm a tax cut, a tax raiser.
This is the point. Nancy Pelosi probably has an absolutely correct assumption that laid out side by side, the positions of the two parties might very well favor her party. But that's not the way it's done. People will hear television and radio commercials endlessly saying, the last thing your representative, your Democrat in Washington did before coming home was pass a tax increase.
Right.
And they won't say only on the rich. And they won't say it was a return to the tax rate that that person had been paying previously. They won't say any of that. They'll just say a tax increase, and they'll probably call it a job-killing tax increase. And a lot of Democrats were afraid of that.
And Democrats have a lot of other things to worry about, too, including nationally, the generic poll between Democrats and Republicans, how voters will vote on November 2nd. And while the chances of the Republicans taking control of the Senate, I think, have decreased, thanks to Christine O'Donnell and other situations like that, too. I think Democrats, for example, Barbara Boxer seems to be opening up a lead in California, for example.
Small lead.
Patty Murray may be doing well in Washington State.
Even smaller lead.
But there's a very good chance that Nancy Pelosi's job may switch over to John Boehner on November 2nd, which is pretty remarkable. And there are a lot of, you know, tough numbers out there that, look, we see President Obama out there. He wants to recreate this magic from 2008, you know, get the young, get the people of color, get the first-time voters out. But we've seen everywhere, even when Ronald Reagan was popular, it's one thing when Reagan is on the ballot, it's another thing when he's off the ballot and tries to get Republican voters to vote GOP. It
didn't
work
for him in either of his midterms. I mean, we remember him as a mythic popular figure, but only in the years when he himself was on the ballot, right. When he wasn't, his party suffered, and suffered a lot. And I think we're going to see that again. There's really no reason to think that this historic pattern that is almost unbroken through our history, certainly caught Bill Clinton in 1994 and knocked him way down. I think we're going to see that pattern again. Now, you're probably right about the Senate, although we can talk a little bit about smoke on the firewall again. I mean, a lot of these Democratic seats they were counting on are not going their way. They may be doing a little better in California and Washington, but Wisconsin has moved substantially in a Republican direction. I think a lot of Democrats there are in shock.
Ohio has moved way away from the Democrats.
I don't think there's any chance for Lee
Fisher. Although that's still a Republican seat. It's not a pickup, right?
That's right. It's not a pickup. Pennsylvania, on the other hand, Pat Toomey is in a strong position,
and that has been a Democratic seat since
Arlen Specter switched parties. Right. And I think the two that everyone's talking about this week are the Richard Blumenthal lead has evanesced in Connecticut.
The Chris Dodd seat,
This is the Chris Dodd seat in Connecticut. And when Dodd stepped down, people said, boy, that's good to get rid of him because he was a goner. Then they got Blumenthal. Then he had a problem with his Vietnam overstatement of his record. But then he seemed to have righted the ship again. And now Linda McMahon, the former Worldwide Wrestling Enterprise executive, is creeping up on him. Everybody's, you know, using a lot of wrestling analogies. But she seems to have gotten a grip here.
Explain that to me. I mean, when we look at all the stories about Linda McMahon, it was always about the widespread steroid use in the industry, the fact that she did not protect the people who ostensibly worked for the WWE. And you know, the last time, I can't even remember the last time a Democratic senator was defeated in Connecticut. I mean, Tom Dodd lost in 70, but as an independent. But I mean, Democrat senators do not lose in Connecticut.
Well, and Richard Blumenthal has not, in fact, actually lost yet. And he's not a senator. He's not an incumbent.
Right.
He's got
the
a
seat,
long
but
record.
The seat itself, right.
And he's been a popular AG, and I think a certain number of people are just sitting there going, well, I'd rather keep him as AG, and I'm mad at Washington, and I want to send an I'm mad vote, and a very large percentage of the people in Connecticut who say they are mad say they're going to vote for Linda McMahon. Now, they may not in the end. They'll learn more about her, and they'll contemplate it maybe a little bit, but Blumenthal is not home safe, and neither, and here's an amazing one, neither is Joe Manchin.
See, that's what's just so remarkable. You think Joe Manchin, reelected in 2008 with 70% of the vote, the highest total any West Virginia governor has ever gotten. He is pro-gun. He is pro-life. He is anti-same-sex marriage. He is basically the social conservative that West Virginia seems to like. However, if you think back to 2008 when Barack Obama was at his most popular, he still got crushed in the West Virginia primary by Hillary Clinton.
He's never been popular in West
Virginia. He lost badly with 43% of the vote to John McCain in November, and that's when he was popular.
But, well, and it's a protest vote against Obama in West Virginia, not against Joe Manchin. In fact, there's another thing at work here, which is if you're John Racy, the Republican nominee, you can say, look, folks, you like Joe Manchin? Fine, I like Joe Manchin. Keep him as your governor. Send me to Washington to send a message to Barack Obama and keep Joe Manchin here in West Virginia where we like him.
You know something? That's a good point, and that reminds me of 1996 in Massachusetts. Bill Weld, very popular governor. John Kerry, maybe not so, but do they want to lose Weld as governor to have him beat Kerry in the Senate? They did not.
And they said to a lot of Republicans,
we want to keep both.
Yeah, you like them both? Keep them both.
The only difference, of course, is Joe Manchin is term limited. He can't run again in 2012, but he'll stay governor for at least 2 more years. And perhaps for all we know, if Racy wins, I still can't imagine that. But of course, Manchin still could come back when Byrd's term would be up.
Fully, in 2012.
That's right.
There could be some rematches in 2012, and we'll get around to talking about those. But there are some other things that are more immediate, including the imminent departure of Rahm Emanuel.
There are imminent indications, and we've been talking about imminent for weeks now, that Rahm Emanuel will leave and formally declare for mayor of Chicago. The deadline is November 22nd. That's the time he has to run.
Yeah, but he'll declare before that. He doesn't want to leave anybody with the impression that he's dithering. I mean, he's clearly going to quit as chief of staff, and he's clearly going to run for mayor of Chicago.
And so maybe that certainly happens. And, of course, the poll, he'll certainly have the money. He will probably have some good, a lot of support in Chicago. The question of who replaces him in Washington, that's the latest parlor game here in D.C.
Well, apparently there's going to be a temporary replacement, and that'll be Pete Rouse, who was formerly the chief of staff for Tom Daschle, who was very close to Barack Obama and advised him during the rise of Barack Obama, 2005, 6, 7.
Rouse is now the deputy chief of staff under Rahm.
And he's there, and he's in place. So he will take the job temporarily while they look around. But, you know, one rumor is that they're not looking around. They're not looking outside the White House. And they're not looking to bring in someone who would have a lot of weight and stature of their own. Somebody like, say, Leon Panetta, now the CIA director, who was chief of staff, at a similar inflection point for the Clinton presidency back in the 1990s.
And you wonder if there is a repudiation of Obama slash the Democrats on November 2nd, you might think that he may want to just redesign his presidency as Bill Clinton effectively did after the 94 debacle.
He truly did. He went off in another direction entirely from what he and Hillary had tried to do in the first 2 years. People interpreted it as centrist, you know, I mean, trying to appeal to Republicans' smaller kinds of causes, and then eventually signing the welfare overhaul that the Republicans passed in 1996 and some other bills that would have to be called moderate to conservative approaches to problems like health care portability and so on, all in 1996 on his own way to reelection. And, of course, the devil's bargain was he knew he was also helping the Republicans keep control of the House and Senate as they did in 96.
As the Democrats realized that there was anger out there, and that goes back to at least the summer of 2009, we've been saying all along that the Democrats learned the lesson of 1994. They've been prepared from the beginning to not let it happen to them suddenly, as it did to many Democrats in 94, and to take steps to protect their reelection chances. And yet, you still see a President Obama out this week trying to rally the troops, trying to recreate the magic, because clearly, at least according to polls, that magic is not there.
Okay, let's talk a little bit about polls, because there's a real difference whether you ask the questions, the generic, do you prefer Republican, Democrat, how do you feel about your representative, how do you feel about voting Republican or Democrat for the Senate or for governor? There's a real difference in the answers you get depending on whether you're talking to, quote, registered voters, which is a pretty objective measure, are you registered or aren't you registered, versus likely voters. Now, a lot of the polls of registered voters are pretty close. Democrats aren't doing nearly as badly, and in some cases they're tied or even ahead among registered voters. But consistently, and this seems to be true all the way across the country, when you shift to likely voters, the Republicans do much, much better, and that's why everyone is assuming they're going to have a huge November 2nd. What's a likely voter?
Well, a likely voter, I think, is someone who has a history of voting and someone who is enthused about this particular election. So I suspect that given what's out there and given the last 19 months of the Obama record, for better or for worse, more Republicans are angry and therefore more enthused and thus more likely to vote, whereas more Democrats, as we saw with Republicans in 74 during Watergate, Republicans in 06 and 08, they just didn't feel like coming out because the news has not been good. Now, I don't know if that holds true. But again, you know, we see, for example, we talked about West Virginia, both Rasmussen, which is a robo automated poll.
And we should talk a little bit about Rasmussen.
Right. But also, and also PPP, which is a left leaning poll. They both have racy up by a couple of points, but they both see it the same way, which is pretty remarkable, which makes me think that there may be this real anti-Democratic wave out there just waiting to happen. But having said that, then you see a whole bunch of polls coming out this week. The Latino vote in California, there's a new Los Angeles Times poll that came out this week that shows Latinos overwhelmingly supporting Boxer over Fiorina in the California Senate race, also supporting Brown over Whitman, not as much, but giving Democrats the lead in both those states because of Latino support. There's a new poll in Ohio, for better or for worse, that shows Governor Ted Strickland, who had been down by double digits to John Kasich all along, now suddenly has made this a contest. So for all the so-called lack of Democratic enthusiasm, maybe it's not going to be the slaughter, the tsunami that so many people are talking about.
And maybe it is, because we still have 4 weeks and some days before November 2nd, and the polls can go up and the polls can go down. And my guess is they will do both. We will see races such as Ohio get tighter, and then we'll see somebody pull away. We'll see races like California looking a little more typically California Democratic, and then we'll see them tighten up again. I think that these polls go back and forth for a variety of reasons, one of which may be voter sentiment, changing, people changing their minds. They go to a debate, they hear a debate, they see some new fact about a candidate they don't like. That happens, and that's legitimate. But I think the other thing is the polls themselves. The polls themselves are far from a perfect science. We are now in a world where any poll done by any methodology with any tiny little sample, 300, 400 people who say they're likely voters, is suddenly treated more or less the same as a Gallup poll or a Pew Research poll.
Treated as a news story.
Right, exactly, as a story. And the consumer of all this, the listener, is going to hear a lot of this polling information and think, what am I to believe? They're contradictory. Some of them seem to be more legitimate than others, but they're all presented by the media in exactly the same way with the same weight.
Right, exactly. That's why I pointed out the reason I pointed out the Rasmussen / PPP similar numbers in West Virginia is sometimes that there are different methodologies and different focuses on registered versus likely voters, and yet sometimes they'll come out with the same results.
All right, and I'm also going to say something that's maybe a little heretical to some people, and that is that I'm not sure that all pollsters are equally interested in the precision accuracy of what they are presenting. That some pollsters are primarily interested in generating a lot of numbers.
And attention.
And getting, as a result, a lot of attention. You look around, take a look at a site like realclearpolitics.com, where they aggregate polls. In some of those instances, let's say 2/3 of the polls in some states have been done by Rasmussen. And so, of course, that overweights what they're finding with their particular methodology, which I think most people would say favors a Republican constituency. If you look at the Rasmussen site, they quite frankly are appealing to people who are coming to them from other conservative media, frankly conservative media. They're quoting conservative commentators about how great Rasmussen polls are. I'm not saying that they aren't legitimate. I'm just saying that they have a little bit of a lean to it. The same thing with PPP, as you say, a Democratic-leaning outfit. But sometimes I have had the sense that they are putting out a kind of worst-case scenario for Democrats with a purpose in mind because they seem to be pushing the numbers. Let's put it that way.
I was in St. Louis just prior to the Delaware primary, and I remember PPP coming out with a poll that had Christine O'Donnell slightly up over Mike Castle.
I believe it was more than slightly.
Well, it was a handful of points. Well, mm-hmm. It was pretty close to the actual number. And I remember thinking, when I get home, I'm going to call right to them and say, what were you guys thinking? Mm-hmm. Sometimes, though, they're right.
Sometimes they are right.
I mean, and I have trouble saying that there's an agenda here one way or the other. And we do know that, yes, Rasmussen did have Scott Brown over Martha Coakley in Massachusetts before anybody else saw that. Matter of fact, some other polls, Democratic polls, had Coakley up by double digits, and they were laughing at Rasmussen mm-hmm. until January 19th when nobody was laughing anymore.
And so, of course, what this comes down to is measuring something that is a fraction of the electorate and trying to predict which people are going to show up in primaries or in very small turnout situations. And we know in presidential elections, roughly half of the voting age population shows up to participate nationally, nationwide. It's much, much higher in some states, 75% in Minnesota, but much lower in some other states, 40-some in Arizona. We also know that in midterm elections, that comes way down. It becomes either, say, 1 in 4 or 1 in 3, depending on the state. But it comes dramatically down. We also know that the people who generally don't participate at the same rate in midterm elections tend to be the minority voters, the younger voters, the lower income voters, and to some degree even women voters, although that's not a big change. Men are more likely to vote relative to men's likelihood to vote in presidential years.
But see, now I would argue that in a wave election, when there's a clear desire for change, that's not necessarily the case. I think in 2006, while of course fewer voters in 2004, there was a significantly larger number of African Americans, women, and young Democratic voters who came out in 2006 than are likely to come out in this midterm election because the tide is going the other way.
That's probably true, but I suspect that it's still less than their participation rates in presidential years.
No question. No question.
And that's really the only point, is just that if it's a presidential year, you see one electorate. In 2008, that electorate was about 75% white. In a midterm election, you see a different electorate. It's smaller, and it's going to be whiter. It's going to be older, and it's going to be slightly more male, not necessarily majority male, but slightly more male, and it's going to be more Republican in every characteristic. And that's not to say there won't also be Democrats who are voting Republican because, as you say, of the zeitgeist, the enormous anger in this wave election. And that's it for this week's political podcast.
You can follow NPR's political coverage at npr.org/politics.
Love that slash. I'm Ron Elving.
And I'm Ken Rudin. I love that, Ron.
Join us again next week for It's All Politics from NPR.